In the New Testament, we find different descriptions for the church. We've talked about this at different times, and we've said that these different descriptions help us see the church from different facets or different aspects. We find, for example, the church being described as a kingdom. It's described as a house. It's described as a flock. So you can probably find at least half a dozen different descriptions. In Revelation 11, we've said that as we look at this chapter, we have a lot of different descriptions, once again, for the church. It's described in Revelation 11, verse 1, as a temple. Well, we have this same description of the church, Ephesians 2, 21 and 22, 1 Corinthians 3, 16, 2 Corinthians 6, I think, verse 16 and so forth. And then as we move down a little bit, he's going to talk about the two witnesses, verse 3. Once again, a reference to the church. And then the two olive trees, verse 4, a reference to the church. The two candlesticks, a reference to the church. So when we see these different descriptions in Revelation 11 of the church, we shouldn't be surprised to see that John uses different illustrations for it, because this is really what we have throughout the entire New Testament. Now, we got through most of Revelation 11, 4 last week, but let's read that to kind of get us back into the groove of things. He says, "These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the Lord of the earth." A couple things about this. We've already seen the candlestick imagery, haven't we? We're at Revelation. Jesus is among the candlesticks or the lampstands. Remember where that is? First chapter. He's walking there among his people. Now, it was seven candlesticks or seven lampstands back there in Revelation 1, and we gave a reason for that when we were back there. Seven of... All right, the seven churches. Seven means completeness, perfection, fullness, so the Lord is there with all of his people. Now, John uses that same illustration, but he reduces the number from seven to two. And we said that two, when you think of it, we talked about this before in the study of numerology, one of the things that would be associated with two would be strength. And here in Revelation 11, there's some information about the church going through difficult times. So as these times come, and I think we're going to see that some of what John has described is probably past. There could be a future illustration of it, but there's a great illustration in the past where we're going to have some things to say about the Dark Ages. God is with his people during these difficult times. Then you also have this other little thing that we didn't deal with. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the Lord of the earth. Some have interpreted that as a reference to Satan, saying that he's the god of this world. Now, that's possible. I can't say that that's the wrong interpretation, but I don't think it's the right interpretation. When you look at verse 4, you may have a cross-reference that goes back to the book of Zechariah, Zechariah chapter 4. We'll not turn back there, but if you were to do that, you'd find at the beginning of Zechariah 4 and at the end of Zechariah 4, he uses the same imagery that we have here in Revelation 11. Now, back there in Zechariah 4, he's talking about, basically a candlestick representative of the Jewish nation. And he's talking about, two things that are, going into this particular candlestick. And one of those things would represent a person. That would be Joshua, the high priest. The other item for the candlestick would be a reference to Zerubbabel. And in Zechariah's original illustration, you have both political leadership and you have spiritual leadership for the nation of Israel. Well, John picks up on that. And back there in Zechariah 4, at the end of the chapter, he talks about this spiritual and political leadership, and he talks about standing before the Lord of the earth. Well, in Zechariah 4, it sure doesn't sound like the devil. It sounds like you've got good spiritual, you've got good political leadership with divine approval standing before, if you will, God. So when John picks up that picture from Zechariah 4 here in Revelation chapter 11, it seems to me that we're definitely dealing with God. And that's once again a way of saying that as the church is out here, especially as they go through the difficult times, who are they standing in front of as far as being, probably not face-to-face with Satan. I mean, that could be the case, but I don't think that's the point here. As the church experiences difficult times, who's right there in the midst of them? All right, the Lord is. God is. Christ, and he's the head of the church. Ephesians 1, 22 and 23. So as congregations go through difficult times and through struggles, and even as they experience the good things, God is right there with them, and that's an important point for us. Let's then pick up with new information, Revelation 11, verses 5 and 6. "And if any man desireth to hurt them..." Well, who are we just talking about? The church. So keep that in mind. "And if any man desireth to hurt them, fire proceeded out of their mouth, and devoureth their enemies. And if any man shall desire to hurt them, in this manner must he be killed. These have the power to shut the heaven, that it rain not during the days of their prophecy. and they have power over the waters to turn them into blood, and to smite the earth with every plague, as often as they shall desire. Now, if you'll notice one other thing there in verse 6, you'll see the word prophecy. Well, who's going to be, and we've said that sometimes this word can be used in the sense of teaching, and this would be how I would understand this term here. Who's going to be doing the prophesying, Christians or non-Christians? All right, Christians, God's people are. So once again, this is a way of reinforcing the fact that we are dealing with Christians. So here God, in Revelation 11, 5 and 6, says to his people, as you're living your life during the Christian era, there are going to be some people that are favorably disposed towards you or unfavorably disposed towards you. They're not going to be very happy with you. They're going to try to attack you. And you can, I think, see that back there in verses 2 and 3. He talked about you've got the temple of God, the church. And then he said it was given unto them, the Gentiles or the nations. That what were they going to do? They're going to tread it underfoot. And that's not a nice thing. They're going to be involved with persecution and so forth. We've already seen some of this in the book back there in Revelation chapter 8. And now God says, during this time, you're not going to be helpless. In fact, there's going to be some options for you. And he describes this as fire coming out of the mouths of God's people and devouring their enemies. And then in verse 6, the imagery is even more vivid. He says, the power to shut the heaven, that it rain not during the days of the prophecy. And they have prophecy over the waters to turn them into blood and to smite the earth with every plague as often as they shall devour, as often as they shall desire. Now, anybody ever breathe fire? Find somebody who's not a Christian and just, I'll take care of you. I've never done that. I've never seen a preacher that's done that. And what about the other stuff that we've got here in verse 6? Anybody ever done those things? They'll have the power to shut the heaven that it rain not. Anybody ever stop the rain? You want to oppose me? I'm just going to shut down the rain on your property. Well, so as we look at this information in Revelation 11, we're not dealing with literal information. You know, we can't literally breathe out fire. We can't literally stop the rain. And the other thing that he says there, to turn the waters to blood. We can't literally do those things. But we have here symbolic language to say, as I have already mentioned, as we go through this life on earth and God's people are opposed, God's going to help us folks. Now, as you think about the imagery that John describes, it, I think, calls back to some things that we have in the Old Testament. Let me give you some examples. Back in Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, we've got the people of God, supposedly. They're complaining about some of the hardships. And they get, you know, after Moses a little bit, and God sends fire among them. Well, that's the same kind of image that we have here. And Moses, of course, he prays for the people. He stops the devastation. You also have in the book of Numbers, chapter 16, especially verse 35, there is this fellow by the name of Korah, and he's involved with a rebellion. As we go back and look at this story, we'll once again find that there was punishment by fire. Remember, we've got the prophet Elijah and the false prophets of Baal. How did that end up for the prophets of Baal? What happened to them? They went home happy? What came down from heaven and destroyed them? It was fire. So when we look at the Old Testament and we see some of the people who oppose God or oppose God's people, fire, and in this case I recognize it was literal fire. You have another story, 2 Kings chapter 1, verses 9 through 12. There was King Ahaziah. He sent a military commander with 50 men over to one of God's prophets, and it wasn't a very nice visit, and those men also died by fire. So we've got a lot of different stories. You have here in Revelation 11, 5, and 6 also reference to plagues. Well, when you hear that word plague, what comes to mind? All right, Moses, Egypt, trying to get his folks out. And you have that same basic principle. God's people were opposed and oppressed. So what did God do? He took care of the oppressor, didn't he? He said, if you want to go ahead and keep my people, the time has come for them to go. I'm going to go ahead and plague you in various ways. You also have the information in verse 5 that's associated with the word killed. And if any man desires to hurt them, fire proceeds out of the mouth, devours their enemy. And if any man shall desire to hurt them, in this manner must he be killed. He's got to be dealt with. Now, today God is no longer acting in the kinds of miraculous ways we just mentioned. He's not, you know, inflicting the plague of locusts and flies and blood on people. And he's not literally bringing fire down from heaven. But do you think that God's unable to act when it comes to the enemies of his people? I would say no. Let's go back and look at 1 Kings chapter 13, verses 21 through 24. And I use this reference specifically because of the word killed in Revelation chapter 11, verse 5. 1 Kings 13, verses 21 to 24. Who'd like to be a reader? All right, Lois, thank you.
13:21 to 24. And he cried to the man of God who came from Judah, saying, "Thus says the Lord, because you have disobeyed the command of the Lord and have not observed the commandment which the Lord your God commanded you, but have returned and eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which he said to you, 'Eat no bread and drink no water,' your body shall not come to the grave of your fathers. And it came about after he had eaten bread and after he had drunk, that he saddled the donkey for him, for the prophet whom he had brought back."
Okay, now this is the story about the old prophet and the young prophet that we mentioned in Wednesday night's class. Remember, the young prophet is sent there to give some information, and God says, you know, go there, do your job, give the information, go back home, don't eat at anybody's house. And, you know, the king says, well, hey, I'll give you up, half my house and come back with me and so forth. And then he meets up with this old prophet, and the old prophet says, "I've seen an angel, and, you know, come back with me." And he did that. He ate bread, and then the old prophet prophesies again. Do you remember what happened to this guy? He's headed back home eventually, and what meets him?
A lion.
And what happens with that lion? All right, he kills him. So you have here a situation where a man violated God's will. He dies because he violated God's will. But when we look at that death, would you put it in the miraculous, or could that be in the providential, the non-miraculous category? People die by lions today? Absolutely. But it's not miraculous. I mean, if God just created one out of thin air and stuck you right there in the cage, I mean, that would be one thing. But you know, there are those natural forces in the world at work. Lives are taken every single day. And when we look at history, this is a good example of what we're talking about in Revelation chapter 11. God can deal with the people who oppose him in various ways. Nobody lives forever. And there are a lot of different ways to go ahead and either stop someone or to take someone's life. So in the 11th chapter, God is saying to his people, you have these forces, but you're not powerless. Back in the Old Testament too, Jeremiah 23:29, God likened his word to a hammer and to a fire. So you've got a lot of symbolic language here to once again reinforce the fact that God says you're not alone. I'm with you. I have power to help you. You have my word. So the church, as it goes through some difficult times, is going to be able to stand. A good cross reference might be Hebrews 12:28. There the Hebrew writer says that we have a kingdom which is unshakable. It's going to stand. Well, that's the same message that we have here in Revelation chapter 11. All right, now with all this information, one might think when it comes to the church, will there ever come a time, or would there ever be a time from John's point on when the church would seemingly go out of business, no longer exist? I would think most people would say no. Well, John, after he lays out this information in 5 and 6, he then comes to Revelation 11:7 and says, here's kind of a footnote. I want you to know that even though God is with his people, he's going to allow the devil to have at least one time in history. And I think this period has already passed. But in Revelation 11:7, John says, I want you to know that there's going to come at least one time in history where it looks like the church built by Christ, the church of Christ, has been completely destroyed. Now, John's going to say in the first part of verse 7 that this time couldn't come until God's people had finished their testimony. Well, what's that sound like? What kind of testimony does a Christian have? All right, you know, his life, God's word, the information about the gospel. So John says this time is going to come, but before it comes, the gospel is going to be able to go throughout the world. People are going to see what Christianity is really like. And then the church, after it's gone through this time where it looks like it no longer exists, it's going to be revived. And we'll see that a little later in verse 11. So some really fascinating material. Anything, though, that you want to add or ask before we pick up with this part of the text? Okay, let's then, Revelation 11, verses 7 and 8. And when, that's an important word, and when they shall have finished their testimony, at that time the beast that cometh up out of the abyss shall make war with them. Who would the then be? The them, all right, Christians or the church. And not only is this war going to be made with God's people, this beast and the war that it launches is going to overpower or overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Now, trying to lay this out in a very logical way, and I think if we go through it sequentially, it'll make sense. Back there in verses 5 and 6, church is going to have some problems. And now as we come to verse 7, God says the time is going to come when his word, the gospel, would be sufficiently broadcast. They had finished their testimony, where now some evil powers, the beast, coming up from the abyss, is going to make war with God's people. And this war, sometimes when you have a war, it's kind of a tug back and forth. You know, this side seems to be winning, this side seems to be winning, and there's no clear winner. But there's some other cases where when you go to war, this side stomps the other side. And God said in describing this particular spiritual conflict, it was going to look like the church got stomped. It was going to look like the church had been completely overthrown and crushed. Now, people have different ideas about this, and we're going to say a little bit more probably towards the end of today's class, and Lord willing, 2 weeks from today, we'll hopefully have a good break because Todd's going to be here and doing the class next week. And if you want, you can find some stuff on the internet to go back and maybe refresh some of the history. But most of us have heard of the Dark Ages, haven't we? Okay, it's been a little while since you've done some looking as far as the Dark Ages. You might want to go back and, you know, that'll help prep you for what we'll want to say in 2 weeks. But I think John is pointing really to the Dark Ages and maybe to a time even beyond that, maybe a time in the future. But the Dark Ages seem to fit very, very well. Were there churches during the Dark Ages? There were. But what kind of church was it? It wasn't the true church. You had some huge, huge issues. The Christianity that existed for, and I use that word in quotes, the Christianity that existed for, you know, hundreds of years, from, you know, at least probably 400 to maybe closer to 1500 BC, you know, you've got about 1,000 years there where it was the Dark Ages. Apostasy had grown and grown. It became more and more rampant, and people were really following the doctrines and the commands. You had during that time a state-controlled church. We think that denominationalism is bad, and it is. But imagine living in a society where the state controls the church. Now, if you've got the state controlling the church, what's that tell you about freedom of religion? You don't have it. I mean, it's pretty much you do it this way, and if we find that you're going this way, we can imprison you and we may kill you. And when we start to go back and look at some of the things that were done, some of the things that were taught, some of the things that were believed and practiced, it really was a bad, bad thing. Anybody ever gone over to the Menahoff in Shipshawana? Okay, if you've not done that recently, if you've never done that, that's a good thing to do, especially for what we're looking at here. And they will give you a lot of church history in about an hour. It costs you about $6 to go through it. But you can kind of get some idea as far as 1,000 years of history of what was done. And, you know, we hear about the Anabaptists and, you know, the Mennonites and some other people that were kind of at the end of the Dark Ages. They were trying to kind of figure things out. You know, what does the Bible teach about this topic? And we've heard about Zwingli and Martin Luther and some others. They were trying to claw their way out of this period of the Dark Ages because it was a period of great, great spiritual ignorance. Catholicism also was one of the things that, you know, came out of the apostasy. And one source, I think, summed it up pretty well when he said, contrary to its claims today. And he's referring here, I think, to the idea, most of us have heard Catholic faith claim that they gave us the Bible. Anybody ever heard that? Okay, well, he rightly says, contrary to that kind of claim, they closed the Bible and took it away from the masses. Every effort was made to keep people from studying it, and many persons lost their lives for no other crime than its possession. The grand movement that history calls the Reformation, and that's what I was describing just a minute ago, was the work of a book, an open book, the Bible. The work of the reformers, and that was, let's go back to the Bible, let's get away from the state-run church, was essentially that of giving the Bible back to the people. It paved the way for the restoration of the Lord's church described in this chapter. And as I said, we'll say a little bit more about this, especially as we get into verses 9 and 10. There could be some additional fulfillments of what John has you know, to describe in this chapter. Can't say for sure, but like I say, the Dark Ages fit this extremely well. When we think about Satan, he's always had throughout time, and especially during the Christian era, a strong desire to do as much damage as he can to the church. Let's skip ahead a little bit. We're in Revelation 11, but let's move across the page to Revelation 12. and see some information about Satan and one of his specific desires that's expressed in verse 15. Somebody want to read that? All right, Scott. Okay, now the verse isn't that complicated if we start thinking about some of the symbols. The serpent, who do you think that stands for? All right, it's got to stand for the devil. Okay, so we've got the devil, and he casts out of his mouth. You think that's literal? No. But he casts out of his mouth after the who? Woman. All right, well, if the devil in Revelation 12:15 stands for the serpent, who do you think the woman's going to represent? The church. All right, so here we've got, coming from the devil's mouth, a river. Once again, it's probably not the case that we're dealing with the devil's literal mouth, I mean, especially if we're talking about a river. So when we think about who we're discussing, the devil, and we know who he's after, the church, when it says there's a river coming out of his mouth, and this river is designed to do what? Wash her away. The imagery is pretty simple, isn't it? What's the devil want to do to the church? He wants to destroy it. You know, just as that river we've seen in recent times, what a river can do, I mean, it can cut away things, it can wash away buildings. John says in Revelation 12, this is Satan's desire. And it's always been his desire, but especially after Christ created the church. He's trying to sweep. And how does he do that? What's the river that comes out of his mouth? It could include... All right, we've got false doctrine, heresies of various kinds, and the world is literally filled with those. Some are quote-unquote Christian... Many are not. There was. All right, sure. You've got apathy. We see that problem with the seven churches. They'd lost their first love, things like that. What about moral problems? Everything that is a negative, I mean, it's like this great river that's rushing from Satan's mouth. So when we tie that in here with Revelation 11, John predicted a time was going to come when it was going to look like the devil was actually winning with several of his plans. Well, now, as we think about that, we can tie in to Ephesians 6, verse 12. Paul said you need to put on what kind of armor? Christian armor. Well, that's important, isn't it? Because is there literally a spiritual war that's taking place in the world? There is. I mean, the devil is actively involved in the process. So is God. He's protecting his people, as we saw from the information in verses 5 and 6 of Revelation 11. All right, so back here in the 11th chapter, we've got Satan's war against the church, especially during this special time. And again, I think the Dark Ages are probably what we have in mind here. And then as we look at verse 8, we have some information as far as how effective Satan and his forces are going to be during this time. And they're what? They're dead bodies. Well, again, a reference to Christians. They lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also the Lord was crucified. Okay, God's people, as you look back to verse 2, do they have a city? Revelation 11:2. All right, they do. Without are outside the temple, leave without, and measure it not, forth hath been given unto the nations, and the holy city. So God's people are a temple, or they're also compared to a holy city. So there's a sense in which God's people have a city. But does our world, the unsaved, also have their city? They do. And that's going to be, of course, the realm, the world of Satan. Now, John describes this unholy habitation of the unsaved, the people who are without or outside the church, in various ways. He describes them as Sodom. He describes them as Egypt. And then he also says or identifies this city as the place where Jesus was crucified. We've said many times when we look at this book, we have to bear in mind that John is using a lot of symbolism. And you can see that here. Where was Sodom located in Jesus' day? Did it exist? No. I mean, it had been wiped out many years before with that fire and brimstone with God. So when he talks about Sodom, it was not, you know, a literal place. Egypt, of course, was a place that existed. So as we think about Sodom, as we think about Egypt, and then this other place that we'll try to identify, we have to understand this information figuratively. Now, if the places are not literal, then what would you suspect about these dead bodies? Are they literal, or are they also probably a symbol? I think they're probably a symbol. And the symbol is these people were still going to be alive physically, but what had happened to their spiritual lives because of the religious apostasy? All right, they had died spiritually. Because, once again, the devil has that great desire to destroy people, Revelation chapter 12. Even the word spiritually that we read in these verses would also suggest that we're dealing with a spiritual kind of apostasy and corruption. Now, of course, we still have corruption as far as religion, but we've also got the existence of Christ's church in the world. It has a definite presence. So even though we still struggle today, it's not nearly to the point that we have described here in Revelation chapter 11. All right, let's think about the places that we read about here. Egypt. What do we know about Egypt? All right, it was a place of bondage. Anything else?
Refuge.
All right, when we think about Jesus and his family, they did go there for a while until some things changed as far as leaders in the area of Israel. Let's go back to the book of Ezekiel for a minute. Ezekiel, we'll look at Ezekiel 16:26, and then if you want to be a reader, we'll also ask you to read verses 49 and 50. I'd also like to get somebody lined up in just a couple minutes for a reference from 1 Kings, 1 Kings 14, verse 24, Scott. 1 Kings 14, 24. All right, let's start with Ezekiel 16:26. Steve.
You also committed harlotry with Egyptians, your very fleshly neighbors, and increased your acts of harlotry to provoke me to anger.
Okay, now, thinking about Egypt, God looking back on them, good folks or bad folks when it came to influence on the nation of Israel? Bad folks. Involved them in sin. And then, too, when we think about the nation of Egypt, was it a religious nation? You both got it right. Steve was nodding his head no, you're saying yes. They were religious, but they were not religiously right. They had their gods. Some think that even Pharaoh was worshipped. But so you have here apostasy in the sense of bad religion, false religion. You also have the moral failings. All right, then we have Sodom. Ezekiel 16, verses 49 and 50. Steve, would you like to read those two verses as well?
Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, took them away as I saw fit.
Okay, so Egypt was bad earlier in Ezekiel. Now we find in verses 49 and 50 of this chapter that Sodom was certainly bad, and the information back there in Genesis about Genesis 18 and 19 would also confirm that. Now, one of the things that I was working on a little bit as I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago was we know that Egypt was religious. We're talking about, you know, religious apostasy here in Revelation 11. Is there any way to believe or conclude that Sodom was also apostate when it came to religion? You know, we know that they were immoral, but were they also religious? And I think there are a couple of indications of that. I went back and really did some digging, and Unger's Bible Dictionary, which is a good source, said, and this is confirmed by some other things that deal with Bible words, they said, and I'm going to give you this quote, the word sodomite meant consecrated or devoted. Now think about that. When you start using the words consecrate and devote, or devoted, what comes to mind? Worship, religion. And then some other things. The same source also noted how those later known as Sodomites in 1 Kings 14, 24. Let's have that read now. Scott, that's you, isn't it?
And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all abominations of the nation that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel.
Okay. Citing this reference, he says, those who later became known as Sodomites were not inhabitants of Sodom, nor their descendants, but men consecrated to the unnatural vice of Sodom as a religious rite. Now, if this source is correct, and as I say, some other sources seem to indicate this as well, that what you have going on there, they were, you know, in the area that we would associate with the Canaanites at a later time. They were apparently involved with sexual sin, which we know about, but that seems to have been linked with religion. So when we think about Egypt, religious apostasy. When we think about Sodom, it appears there that there was religious apostasy as well. And that lines up very well with Revelation 11. As far as people were still going to be religious, But it was going to be this false religion, and especially, I think, the false religion that we see throughout the so-called Dark Ages. Steve?
Not only was Sodom sinful with its physical and sensuality and everything, but their pride was a sinful thing, too.
Yeah, they had multiple problems, and pride was certainly one of the things that God followed them for. Sherman, did you have a thought?
Yeah, my commentary also mentions about the persecution and oppression of God's people there, and it references Exodus 3:7-9.
Yeah, you do have that with, I think, and we're going to make this point with a third item as well, but with Sodom, Peter says that Lot was vexed by how these people acted, so there was persecution there. You know that there was persecution with the Egyptians, especially after Moses showed up and said, "Let my people go." They didn't take that very well. We're going to go ahead and increase the burdens. So these were two perfect Old Testament illustrations when you begin to look at all the elements that we mentioned and some of the things that would have been associated with the Dark Ages. All right, now let's deal with this third place. We've got Sodom. We've got Egypt. And now what's the third area that John describes? The place where the Lord was crucified. Now, at first blush, that would probably seem to be a reference to what or where? Jerusalem. Now, we know that Jesus was crucified not in Jerusalem, but Hebrews 13:12 tells us that it was outside the gate. So it was in the general proximity of Jerusalem. Now, it's possible that John was actually describing Jerusalem. But we've said that this book has a lot of symbolism. Sodom's not literal. When we look at Egypt, once again, a figurative description of the kinds of things that we mentioned. You've got the hostility towards God's people. You've got the moral failings. You have the religious apostasy. It seems to me that John may be saying that this wasn't Jerusalem. What would an alternative view be? The place where Jesus was crucified. Maybe not the actual place, but the... All right, I think Rome. He was crucified not really by the authority of the Jews. It was the authority of Rome. They were the ones who had the power. And when we look at the ancient world, do we find persecution of God's people, the point that Sherman made? Did the Romans persecute God's people? Oh yeah. Were they morally corrupt? Oh yeah. You begin to look at some of the temples and what was done there, they got an A+ in that. And what about false religion? They had their gods all over the empire. So Jerusalem was bad. You know, and you could very likely make a case for them that he's talking about literal Jerusalem. But it seems to me, since we're dealing with so much symbolism, you've got three very powerful symbols here to say that you've got these bad folks in the world. And from among the peoples, let's go back here to verse 8 again. And their dead bodies lie in the street of the great city. And then he says, spiritually, and he kind of lumps these all together. You've got Sodom, you've got Egypt, and these descriptions are a way of describing just how bad it was going to be for God's people. I wanted to give you some other information here. As far as a couple cross-references, I think that's going to come up just a little bit later. So, just kind of a quick summary before we pick up with verses 9 and 10 then. John's telling his people, look, God's folks have suffered badly in the past. Sodom, Egypt, you've seen what's taken place with Rome. But he says, as bad as this is, remember, he's pointing to a time when what's going to be true of the church? It's going to look like it disappeared. And that's John's warning. So he said, when that time comes, Christians should not be surprised. And the Dark Ages, as I mentioned, fit this very, very well. Anything that you want to add or ask as far as something that we didn't cover or something that you'd like some clarification on? It may, and as I said, at least one of the fulfillments, I think, Bessie, would be the Dark Ages. So I'm pretty confident in saying that was definitely included. Now, whether or not sometimes you have some dual fulfillments or things will look forward to more than one event, and maybe that same kind of thing is going to happen at a future time where it just seems like, we do know that the church goes in cycles. And it's true for local congregations. People, if you talk to Christians, who have been members, especially folks who have been members at various congregations for very long, they will tell you that at the places where they've worshipped, and this is true for, I think, across the board, even in the business world, you have times at work where years are great. And then maybe the next year, the next 6 months, it's like, boy, do I still want to work here? I mean, it's bad. It's depressing. And then, some things change. And then, kids, raising kids, you've got the good times and you've got the bad. Life is really a period of cycles. Health, you know, people go through good times and bad times. And, you know, religion has also been like that over the years. But we may come to another time where it looks like the church is basically stamped out. But verse 11 says, don't worry. Sure. Yeah. Right. To some degree, we can see the same kinds of thing today. You have persecution. When it comes to talking about that, they don't receive it very well. You have false religion. They say, hey, that's, you know, that's perfectly fine. And all the other things that are wrapped up here in Revelation 11 is just not to the same degree. But you're right. We see the same things throughout time. It's It's true. Okay, we mentioned with the fire illustrations of how that seems to be tied in with several Old Testament stories, some of which would be in the book of Numbers, number 16, for example. And John drew from that to say God helped his people in the past. When we think about the shedding of the rain, or shedding of the heavens, so the rain stopped. Who was the prophet that stopped the rain for 3.5 years? It was Elijah. So it was another example. Here was someone who needed some assistance, Elijah. This is what he did. So John recalled that historical reference to say, just as God helped his people in the past, he's going to help his people now. He has the power to do it. And some of that power is going to be providential. He's going to work within nature. Some of that power is going to be through his word. Okay, building on what we've said, let's look at verses 9 and 10. And from among the peoples and tribes and tongues and nations, do men look upon their dead bodies 3.5 days, and suffer not their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. And they that dwell on the earth rejoice over them and make merry. And they shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. Now, whether John described the Dark Ages, as we've mentioned, and I think is correct, and again, there may be another time throughout the Christian era, verses 9 and 10 are not that difficult to understand. When we look at the New Testament, let's look at a couple references. We'll have somebody head back to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 20 and verses 29 and 30, and then 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Who'd like to pick up our Acts 20 reference? All right, Brian, Acts 20, and that will be verses 29 and 30. Then our 1 Timothy reference is 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1, 2, and 3. Dolores. All right, Brian, if you're ready, Acts 20, verses 29 and 30.
For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing your flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them.
Okay. Did Paul say apostasy was going to come? He did. And not only did he say that apostasy was going to come, he said it's going to come where? From inside. So we have, when we think about apostasy, things were pretty good for the first century. But you have apostasy eventually coming from the outside. You remember that state-controlled church? Anytime the state gets involved in things, it usually doesn't go very well, even the federal government. And when they start messing with religion, things really get upset. So if you have problems from the outside, and you have problems from the inside, you're going to have a big mess. And usually it just gets worse and worse and bigger, and that's why I say people eventually got to the point, after about 1,000 years, they were clawing, literally, for the light, trying to, you know, read the Bible and, you know, get the Bible back into the hands of people and read the scriptures and think, okay, what's right? You know, the state church teaches infant baptism, the state church teaches this, and we've been told this, but these things don't seem to line up with the scriptures. And it took a while for people to really start sorting out truth from error, but I mean, it was, when they call it the Dark Ages, it really was a period of great spiritual blindness. And then Paul also talks about this in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3.
The Spirit clearly says that in later times some will abandon the faith and follow deceiving spirits and things taught by demons. Such things come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. They forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received.
Okay, Paul said the Spirit says what? Clearly, expressly, the Holy Spirit has predicted that a time is going to come when there's going to be apostasy. And he actually gives some specific examples of that. And we, you know, as we go back and we start looking at some of the history, this is precisely what happened. We, during this time of year, see people rolling a snowball. You know, you get a little handful of snow and it doesn't seem like it's that big. But you start rolling it around, and after a while, what do you have? You've got a monster snowball. And that's what happened with this religious apostasy. Once the seeds were sown, little by little, and it literally killed the folks. There in verse 8, sometimes, as we mentioned, people were physically killed, but the spiritual lives were really destroyed. In the next chapter, if you skip over just a little bit, Revelation 12, verse 6, the woman, and we've already talked about her, a reference to the church, the woman fled where? In the wilderness. Why do you think the church would have to flee? Why do people have to run today?
Persecution.
All right, persecution. So John, still talking about God's people, had to find a place prepared by God, that there she could be nourished for 1,203 score days. So the church has always been under a state of great persecution. And John described, as we look at Revelation 11, a time of persecution for the truth and the promoting of error that was just really, really unbelievable. From about the fourth century onward, things were especially difficult. Those who were trying to follow the Bible were maligned. They were misrepresented. We've talked about this at various times before. If you, for example, were part of some of those assemblies, you get together and you have the Lord's Supper, what were you sometimes accused of? Partaking of Jesus' body and bread. All right, you're accused of being a cannibal. Well, that's not true. We certainly wouldn't be involved with that. But, you know, you start spreading that word, and that's probably going to put you on the hit list for the federal government. All right, then, Christians, you also have some references to this. Jude talks about the love feast. So they would say, oh, those Christians, we need to hunt them down because they're involved with immorality. It's incest that's taking place over there. So they began to come up with these ideas, and it really became a difficult time. Now, for us, Bibles are relatively inexpensive. You can go down to maybe the dollar store and find a dollar store Bible, you know, for a buck, and, you know, pay the dollar in tax and you're good. We have Bibles on cell phones and everything else. But if you were living during this time, you think the printing presses were available and printing out Bibles? No. If you wanted a Bible, you might not ever see one, and you might find it chained to some religious group and you're not allowed to go ahead and touch it. If you go over to the Menahoff, you'll find there in the tour a little room where they've got people represented who are trying to do what's right. They were hunted. You can see some of the tools that were designed to hunt and to capture and control people. Bibles were rare. They were costly. And it was also during a time where people, oddly enough, were trying to ban the scriptures. And if they could find a Bible, they knew the power of the book, so what would they do with it sometimes? You're the state. You find a Bible? Well, we don't want that to be put into the hands of folks. We're the state-controlled church. So what are we going to do? We're going to burn it. We're going to destroy it. So you have a lot of copies, a lot of the copies of the scriptures that were lost during this particular time. And for us, we think, well, we really don't think. When we need some help, we may Google some information as far as the Bible. We'll pick up a concordance or another tool. You think they had Strong's Concordance back then? No, you think they had Bible dictionaries, Bible encyclopedias? None of the commentaries that we have today. So here you have people, once again, they're trying to claw their way out of the religious ignorance that has built steadily, and it's gotten worse and worse. Can't, for the most part, access a Bible. And even if they can get a Bible, they have really no study tools. Not much of a historical basis to go back and study the scriptures. So at that point, what's Satan done? It looks like he's won. It looks like he has literally taken the Bible from the people and he has put a veil of ignorance over the minds of people that will probably never be undone. But God said in verse 11, there was good news. And he says, and after the 3 days and a half, do you remember how we've defined that 3 days and a half, that three and a half, also referred to as how many months? 42 months, or how many days? 1,260. If 30 days are in a month, then you can come out with 42 months, you can come out with 1,260 days. And we said that is, it's also half of seven. So we said that this particular figure is a time, whether it's 42 months, 1,262 days, or three and a half, it's a time to describe the opposition that God's people would experience throughout the Christian era. And if you look carefully at what we said, the three and a half is associated with years, months, or days. days. So that is also an indication when we have that word day, it is going to be a period of great difficulty. But day in contrast to year would indicate what to us? If it said 3.5 years, Satan's probably going to win for all time. But it says 3.5 days. There's going to be this great period of spiritual darkness, but it's going to be limited. God's going to temper it. And then if you look ahead a little bit at verse 11, this will set things up for 2 weeks from today. And after the 3.5 days and after the breath, the breath of life from God entered into them. That would be the church that seemed like it had disappeared. And what happened? They stood upon their feet. So here we have the devil. It seems like he's won. But God says, hey, John, guess what? You also, as you predict this bad time, you say a time's going to come when there's going to be a resurgence. There's going to be this revival. And once again, that would seem to me to point to what we refer to as the end of the Dark Ages. We go back and we look at some of the history. As far as the church, you've got James O'Kelly, you've got Thomas and Alexander Campbell, you've got some other preachers going back and saying, let's go back to the Bible. No addition, no subtraction. Let's do things as we find them recorded in the scriptures concerning the New Testament church. And that church is revived. And we live in that period today. Now, once again, there may be a time where this kind of thing happens again. We don't know for sure. But at least there's been one clear-cut example of it.